Tonight we'll continue with our study, who were the 12 disciples or apostles? Last time we talked a little bit about biblical tradition and different ways that traditions inform us, because quite frankly a lot of things we know about those 12, and especially their later lives, come from traditions. Traditions of the church, traditions not just of the official church as it eventually came to be, but oftentimes the various churches as they developed. Some of them seemed to be rather orthodox, and some of them took other writings as sources for different things, including teachings of Jesus. Quite frankly, a number of churches used a wide range of things, many of which are in both the Old Testament Apocrypha, which is between the Old and New Testaments, and then a lot of New Testament apocryphal works, a number of which are found in a collection known as the Nag Hammadi Library. It was found in Nag Hammadi, Egypt, actually in 1945, before the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. And there are a lot of different things in there, such as the Gospel of Thomas the Contender, the Sophia Iesu, or Wisdom of Jesus, the Docetic Gospel of Peter, the Apocryphon of James, the Apocalypse of James, the Gospel of the Hebrews, the Gospel of the Ebionites, and on we could go. And other things, the Acts of Peter and the other apostles. Not the Acts of the Apostles, but the Acts of Peter and the other apostles, and all kinds of other things. The Shepherd of Hermas, the Epistle of Barnabas, and on we could go. And some of these things are where some of the legends about the different disciples and what happened to them originate for us. Because, quite frankly, the biblical text says very little about most of them. If you want to get right down to it, the Bible itself says very little about most of those 12 who were closest to Jesus. And last time we started alphabetically, we talked about Andrew, Bartholomew, James the Less, or the younger, the son of Alphaeus. And as time ran out, actually as overtime kicked in last time, we were dealing with James the Elder, the son of Zebedee, also called Boanerges, one of the sons of Thunder, his brother John. By the way, if Francis hasn't shown you the picture, at some point in time, maybe Francis will have the picture. She brought it to Bible study Wednesday. Mentioned in the Sistine Chapel that Bartholomew, who was supposedly flayed alive, his symbol is three knives, but Bartholomew, also known as Nathaniel, in the Sistine Chapel, as Michelangelo paints it, is holding his skin. And sure enough, Francis brought an increased picture from a trip to the Sistine Chapel, and sure enough, the internet? Okay. Well, I thought it was something you had. Oh, you just had the big thing and not the other. But anyway, she got it off the internet, printed it out, and there's Bartholomew. He's actually wearing skin, so it's not, you know, just muscles or bones, but he's holding his skin, and there's a knife in this hand, and he's holding skin draped over his arm. And that's how Michelangelo pictured him and with his death. When we come to James, the son of Zebedee, also known as one of the sons of Thunder, we always find him tag-teamed with his brother John. It's always James and John, James and John. In fact, it's interesting, you don't ever find it listed, John and James. I don't know if they were doing alphabetical back then, too, or not, or maybe James the Elder, the son of Zebedee, and his brother John, the son of Zebedee. I don't know if James was older. The elder doesn't mean that he was older than John here. The elder is to distinguish him from the other James, James the son of Alphaeus, who was the younger. But James and John, the sons of Thunder, are always linked together in the lists of the disciples or in stories in which we find them. He too was a fisherman from Bethsaida and Capernaum, not too far apart. He was part of the inner circle. Remember, we mentioned that Peter, James, and John are kind of the triumvirate, the top three in the pecking order in Jesus' 12 disciples. He is mentioned 30 times total in the New Testament, 3 times in Matthew, 10 in Mark, 7 in Luke, 9 in Acts. And then he is considered by many, or assumed to be, not only the beloved disciple, but tradition also says he wrote 1st, 2nd, 3rd John and the Apocalypse. Now the assumption is that he was the beloved disciple that's mentioned 5 times in the Gospel of John. Notice I didn't list John, the Gospel of John, as having John, the son of Zebedee, mentioned. Several times, in fact, 5 times in the Gospel of John, we find the beloved disciple, the beloved disciple, the beloved disciple. And it was supposedly the beloved disciple that was present at the foot of the cross, the only one of the disciples that was present at the foot of the cross when Jesus was crucified. And it is in the Gospel of John, at the crucifixion, where Jesus looks down upon his mother and the other women standing there, and generally the third saying from the cross. They're called the 7 last words. I've had students before, we talk about all 7 sayings. We talk about how that's what the 7 last words mean. And then they'll try, I'll ask them on a test, list and discuss the meaning of the 7 last words of Jesus. And they'll take one, no one of them only has 7 words, but they'll leave a word out or add a word and put in just one that has 7 words. And I said, no, it's all the 7 sayings. But the third saying from the cross comes from the Gospel of John, chapter 19, where Jesus looks down at his mother and the other women and the beloved disciple and says, "Woman, behold your son." And then to the disciple, the one whom he loved, he says, "Behold your mother." And from that day on, the text says, he took her as his own mother. The presumption is that that was John, one of the sons of thunder. And if you look at Da Vinci's painting of the Last Supper, not only is it incorrect from the standpoint that they weren't standing or sitting, they would have been low to the floor, but it's kind of tough to paint all those guys lying on one elbow at the floor level. But if you look at the one that is supposedly John, the beloved disciple on the right-hand side, what does he look like? Does he look like a son of thunder and a fisherman? He looks very effeminate, very emaciated, etc. And that's where Dan Brown and all the, took off from some of these conspiracy theorists that it really was Mary Magdalene, but it's not. But he doesn't look anything like a big strapping fisherman. And he doesn't look like he's been weathered by the sun, S-U-N. So I just kind of wonder sometimes if that really, although Da Vinci went around and found actual models that he used to paint those faces. And it took him years to find the model for Judas. I think it took him like 3 or 4 or 5 years when he had painted everybody else to find the model. And he found that model. This is one of the legends. I've read in several places that it supposedly was corroborated. Don't know. It makes a nice story, whether it is or not, or an interesting story, that Da Vinci, when he was looking for that person, finally found somebody's face. And it was in a prison, where a person was in prison for life. And he painted. He got the guy to agree to let him paint his face for a painting. Didn't tell him exactly which one. And then when he finished, he let the guy look at it. And supposedly the guy took in a deep breath and tears started welling up in his eyes. And when he told Da Vinci, he said, "I'm sorry that this is, where you have found me and how you have painted me." He said, "You may not remember, but years ago," and he pointed to the face of Jesus, he said, "That was my face." Supposedly the guy who had sat in as a model as a young man, an older boy or young teenager, was the face of Jesus. Several years later in prison was the face of Judas. Interesting legend. But the assumption is he was the beloved disciple. He was a cousin of Jesus, James and John, were cousins of Jesus. So was John the Baptist. But James and John, the sons of thunder, and maybe that's why Jesus called them sons of thunder too, because he knew them very well. If they were cousins, he would have known. Maybe they got into, although I don't know that I'd want to get into too many physical battles or scuffles with Jesus, you know, but maybe they got into scuffles when they were younger. But he was a cousin of Jesus. Zebedee was at least a semi-wealthy man because the text says, the Bible says, that he had hired servants. And only someone who had done well in business could afford to hire servants, or had a lot of land or inherited property and money could afford to have hired servants. James and John were actually in the fishing business with Simon Peter and Andrew. And so, along with James, he is the one who asked Jesus to call down, in Luke chapter 9, to call down destruction on the Samaritan village. So once again, here we've got this image of one who has this temper. He's one of the sons of thunder. He and his brother, when the Samaritans reject Jesus and their teachings, want to call down fire and brimstone from heaven to destroy everybody and everything in this Samaritan town, and Jesus rebukes them. And yet he was the beloved disciple and this effeminate-looking figure in Da Vinci's painting, and wrote 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. Interesting. Maybe, I don't know, you know, personalities change over time. So maybe that's what happened. He and his brother, in Mark and in Matthew, we have stories where James and John, in one instance, James and John asked that they were arguing that they be Jesus' right and left-handed men in his kingdom. In the other story, their mama came, his aunt, says, you know, I'm your favorite aunt, and these ought to be your favorite cousins. And when you get to your kingdom, you need to let one sit on your right hand and one sit on your left hand. And that's where Jesus talks about how basically everyone thinks like the Gentiles do, whose authority is lorded over them, but in my kingdom it shall not be so, for the greatest among you will be least, and the first among you would be last and servant of all. He is also the one who was sent. If you go to Luke chapter 22, when preparations were being made for the Last Supper, verse 8, so Jesus sent Peter and John, saying, go and prepare the Passover meal for us that we may eat it. So not only was he present at the raising of Jairus' daughter, not only was he present along with James and Peter at the Transfiguration, not only was he present for other things, he was one of the ones, along with Simon Peter, who was specifically chosen to prepare, to go to the place where they would eat this meal and to make the preparations, that is, to set up the room, to make sure it was set up properly. They probably didn't, the lady of the house did, but to make sure it was set up properly and make sure that the food was going to be there and prepared for them to have this final meal. So he did have some authority and some power. But once again, what is the power and authority that Jesus gives to them both right here? It's not the power to lord over, it's the power of, that's right, Harold, service. The power of service. Which later on becomes one of the key ingredients for the selection of deacons. The power and the authority deacons are given in Acts chapter 6 is the authority to serve. To serve the needs of the church. To serve the needs of the outcasts and the ones who are poor. And so he is sent with Peter to prepare that Last Supper as a servant. And I think it's kind of interesting, personally, especially given the fact we just mentioned that in one of the Gospels they are arguing over who's greatest and they want to sit beside of Jesus in the kingdom. In the other Gospel, the mama says, now listen, I'm your favorite aunt and these are your favorite cousins and you ought to put them side by side. They were looking for authority, and what does Jesus send him to do? Serve. After Jesus said, whoever would be greatest would be least and must be the servant of you all. He did travel with Simon Peter, and in various ways in sharing the good news. He was also imprisoned with him in the book of Acts. He sent with Peter to Samaria in Acts chapter 8 to check on the teachings of Philip the evangelist. Different Philip, we'll find out. We'll talk about different Philip from Philip the disciple. In fact, we don't know a whole lot about Philip the disciple. We don't know a whole lot about Philip the evangelist, but we do know something about the family of Philip the evangelist. He had four daughters who themselves prophesied and preached. But he was sent with Simon Peter to Samaria, the Samaritan church. And we'll talk more about it later when we do get to Simon Peter, and that won't be tonight, that'll be probably next week. But Simon Peter did become not only a leader within the church and a primary leader within the church, but it was also Simon who in some ways determined whether to recognize your church as a legitimate Christian congregation or not, either by traveling there and hearing what was being said, or by getting reports from other folks, Paul or other disciples or delegations, and Simon Peter would kind of consult with the other disciples that were in Jerusalem and determine whether you could be recognized as a legitimate church or not. I mean, like it or not, that's the way historically it started to develop. But he did travel with Simon Peter and was imprisoned with him. We read that in the book of Acts. Paul, in Galatians chapter 2, verse 9, writes about John and James and Cephas, or Cephas, also Peter, the rock. And when James and Cephas and John, who were acknowledged pillars, speaking of the church, recognized the grace that had been given to me, they gave to Barnabas and me the right hand of fellowship, agreeing that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised. So Paul, in writing to the Galatians and reviewing his apostleship, because there have been questions about whether he's really an apostle or not, within the earliest church, the apostles had to be somebody who saw the earthly Jesus and had followed the earthly Jesus, even to the point of his crucifixion. Here, Paul calls Peter, James, and John pillars of the church. So James and John were still part of that recognized triumvirate as the church began to develop. Now, tradition states that he authored the Gospel of John, which is really kind of interesting in some ways, and he may have. But you've got a fisherman who writes a very glowing and deeply theological interpretation of what God is doing in Jesus, which is really something amazing for a fisherman to do. But also, another thing which some scholars say is an indication that John did author the Gospel of John is that his is the only gospel of the four to talk about Jesus having a preliminary hearing in front of Caiaphas before going in front of the whole group. But tradition states he authored the Gospel of John, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and the Apocalypse, or the Book of Revelation. Now, I list here some of the folks some of the folks in the early or the developing church who said that. The 4th century historian, church historian Eusebius, Polycarp, Irenaeus, Justin Martyr, who was himself an attorney and a leader in the church, Tertullian, Clement of Alexandria. Tradition also says that he left Jerusalem. He lived and preached for a while in Ephesus. And if he is indeed the author of the Apocalypse, the Book of Revelation, then we know he was exiled to the island of Patmos by the Roman emperor. Tradition also states that he is one of the few that died of old age and not martyrdom. Although there is a tradition that said he was given a chalice full of poison, by a supposed friend to try and kill him, but God spared his life. And that's why one of the symbols of John, the son of Zebedee, is a chalice with a snake. Sarah won't even have a cup with a snake on it, much less a snake in it, right? But a chalice with a snake in it to represent not only the poison, but the fact that it was an acquaintance that tried to kill him. Some interpreted that and interpreted or gave the sign with the snake as to try and say it was the devil trying to get rid of him. But that's a rather fanciful understanding. There were two Judas, as we talked about last week when we had the little test at the beginning to see who could list the 12 disciples with your Bible closed. There were two Judases, Judas Iscariot and Judas Thaddeus, also known as Lebbeus in Matthew. Going alphabetically, we'll talk a little bit about Judas Iscariot first. Judas is the Greek form of either Jude or Judah. And interestingly enough, there were a lot of folks that named their sons Jude and Judah, or the Greek Judas, within Jewish society. And those Jews who later became Christians, many of them earlier had children that they named Jude or Judah or Judas. But after the betrayal, after what happened, the names Jude and Judah, or the Greek version Judas, kind of took a nosedive, didn't become such a popular name anymore. It's kind of like, I was trying to think the other day. I know people who are named Ben, but predominantly, but as far as I know, always because their name is Benjamin. Anybody in here know someone named Benedict, other than the Pope? Well, I don't know too many Adolfs either. I kind of thought one time that maybe I was kind of surprised they didn't change their name from Adolf's meat tenderizer, but they didn't. But anybody know someone named Benedict? Why? But there used to be people named Benedict. But why not? Well, yeah, you've got that. Yeah, but because of Benedict Arnold. That's right. That's why the name Benedict kind of fell off the radar screen or off the cliff. Same thing with Jude and Judas. He was the son of Simon. His father's name was Simon. And he was from a village known as Kerioth, or a town known as Kerioth. Mentioned this before. Kerioth was in Judah. In fact, he is not a Galilean and the only Judean in that 12. The only one from Judah. Which is really kind of interesting since Jerusalem, the city of David, is in Judah. But Judas Iscariot was from the town known as Kerioth. Kerioth was known as a haven for zealots. Zealots who believed that they were very militant and they looked for an earthly political kingdom with a Messiah as an earthly political king. But as we have said before, and you're probably tired of hearing it, but I'm going to say it again. As we have said before, the word Mashiach or Messiah simply means the Lord's anointed or the anointed one. And the first person of whom that term was really used in an authoritarian kind of role was King Saul when he was anointed. He was God's representative on the earth. David was the next one. Solomon was the next one. And that became such or so associated with the idea of an earthly political ruler. I mean, even in Isaiah, we read in chapter 9 of Isaiah, a son has been given to us, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. And it talks about peace and righteousness, and it says, upon the throne of David and over his kingdom to rule with justice and righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. King of David, the throne room of David. And there was this belief that Messiah would set up once again a kingdom very much like David's earthly kingdom. And the zealots were looking for that. The zealots were a militant band who really wanted to once again restore the Davidic rule, where everything was united and the Jews were powerful. And so they were looking for someone that they could tout as the Messiah who would get rid of the Romans. And then once they got in power, some of those zealots felt, well, then we'll get to help rule and reign and stomp on other people instead of getting stomped on and kicked in the face. There may be some evidence. There are those who think that Judas may have been a zealot who, after following Jesus for 3 years, thought he had found that Messiah that they were looking for, and then here at the last minute, Jesus says, "Well, my kingdom's not of this earth, and I'm going to be tortured, and I'm going to be killed." And I mean, how would you feel if you followed somebody for 3 years like that, fully convinced that they were this leader, and all of a sudden they seem to wimp out? I mean, Judas gave the money back. He got 30 pieces of silver, but he gave it back and then went out and killed himself because he couldn't live with himself for what he did. Even though there are different legends about how that happened. But there are those who think perhaps he got so upset that Jesus wasn't going to be the Messiah he wanted him to be. He put him in this place, and when he realized Jesus was going to die, if you go to Matthew 27, he comes and says, "Wait a minute, hold on, I betrayed innocent blood. Here's your money back." And I said, "Big deal, you got to live with it. We don't want it back." And he doesn't even run to the bar and drown his sorrows. He throws the money down, runs out, and hangs himself. So, whether he was or not, there may be that in his background. We know Jesus had at least two zealots, Simon the Zealot and Judas Iscariot. He was a betrayer of Jesus. John, the writer of the Gospel of John, said he was the group's treasurer and used to steal money from it. Don't know if that's the case or not. That might be a case of trying to find some reason to blame him. But he said he was the church treasurer. Excuse me, the group's treasurer. Church treasurer. I've known some of those too. My first cousin's husband, who was a CPA, I may have told some of y'all this story before, but Jerry and Ellen went to a church in little church in outside of Greensboro one time. And they didn't have a church treasurer, and so Jerry agreed. They knew he had been what he was in, so he agreed to be the church treasurer, and in 1 year he decided, or after the first year, he decided he was going to produce a financial report at the end of the year. And he got called into the preacher's office and said, "We don't do that. We've never done that." That's preacher been there 15 years. Said, "We've never done that. We don't do that. Nobody needs to know that." So Jerry started digging around and he said, seems like that most of the money got spent by the preacher, or there was a relative of the preacher that before had been the church treasurer. All that kind of stuff. And so he said, "Well, I've got this letter ready, and I got a financial report," and the preacher said, "If you give that to anybody or say anything to anybody about it, I will make sure that you get run out of this church." So he resigned as treasurer. And his parting shot was to, at his expense, mail a copy of his letter and the financial report to all the deacons, well, not just the deacons, to the entire, every family in the church, the entire membership. So, John says he was the treasurer of the group. He gave back the money and killed himself. In Matthew, he hangs himself. In Acts chapter 1, says he buys his field and he goes out and he starts looking at it and he trips and falls and swells up and explodes. It's probably somewhere between the two. Because if you read in Matthew, after he throws the money down, the religious leaders say, "We can't take that back and put it in the coffers of the church because it's blood money." So they went out and they bought a potter's field in which to bury indigents. I don't know. My personal opinion, that 75 cents at Walmart or $1 or $1.25 other places to get you a drink in a drink machine. But there might be some truth in both. That maybe where he hung himself, because that's desecrated ground because he committed suicide, they bought that for the potter's field. And after a while, a rope snapped and he just hit the ground and popped open like a ripe melon. In any case, he was dead. His symbol is a money purse with pieces of silver falling out. Or sometimes his symbol is a noose. There's also another interesting legend about Judas. We consign him to to the nethermost reaches of hell, and some people put him in a lake of fire. Dante Alighieri in the Inferno actually put him in a lake of ice, because, you know, ice burns just as like fire does. But there is one legend that he is in a lake of fire, which is in the mouth of the devil. I don't know where they got that, but and that one day out of a year, this is really a strange kind of thing. Judas is allowed to leave hell to go to the Arctic and sit on an iceberg to cool himself off for the next year. That's a legend back from a couple of centuries ago. That one day out of the year he's allowed to leave hell and go sit on an iceberg. But you know. Well, there are some people who.
Because somebody had to betray Christ or whatever.
Well, yeah, the betrayal. They're actually. I have over the years heard four different theories about why he did what he did. The first one, and most obvious, is the money. But, you know, 30 pieces of silver. That was the price of a common slave on an average slave on the auction block. Was 30 pieces of silver. If he really was after the money, you know, the question has to be raised. You know, he could have asked for 300 pieces and they would have given it. That's how badly they wanted, and they were the wealthy guys. 30 pieces of silver is also something called good faith money. If you agreed to turn somebody over to the authorities, they'd offer you good faith money, and if you agreed to take it, then they knew you weren't setting them up and they could believe you. But the money. Second one, Luke says that at the Last Supper, then the devil entered into him and he went to find them to betray him. Cliff Wilson, the devil made me do it. Remember Geraldine? The devil made me do it. Of course, one of the questions there is, and maybe he was susceptible, and it's a lesson about what could happen if you aren't careful and you give in to the temptations of the devil. But if the devil made him do it, then they both have to take the blame, not just one. I have had a lot of folks over the years to say it was a combination of the money and the predestined will of God. That somebody had to do it. This is the way God worked it out. And so God predetermined that Judas was the one that was going to do it. He had no choice. And I've had people raise the question in that one. Well, but if he had no choice, then how could God condemn him? But if you're a Calvinist, a strong Calvinist with the whole idea of double predestination, which Calvin pushed, God determines ahead of time who's going to be saved and who's going to be damned, and there's not a thing you can do about it, and there's no question you can really raise about it. It doesn't seem like a fair thing if God predetermined that Judas was going to do it. But and then the fourth one is that he's a zealot who got angry and upset and tried to force Jesus' hand to be the Messiah that he thought he was going to be. That he never intended for him to die. Dante puts him there. Frederick Buechner, New Testament theologian, says that if Jesus didn't die for somebody like Judas, he didn't die for anybody, because how many times do we betray Jesus in our lives? And then people will say, oh, but he didn't come back and repent. He just went out and killed himself. That's what we have. But yeah. Only Judas and God know if, by chance, between throwing down the money in the temple, point A and point B, the noose, he asked for forgiveness or not. We don't know. Right, it would seem to be, but only God knows for sure. Well, and Judas too. But I'm not trying to. Judas did a horrible thing. I'm not trying to whitewash him at all with that. But there may be more to what happened than we often think or often hear. The next one is Judas Thaddeus. Thaddeus means one who praises, also known as Lebbeus, which means man of the heart. He was the son of Alphaeus, also known as Cleophas. See, it gets confusing sometimes when and one gospel they're told by one name, and another gospel they're told by another one, even mamas and daddies. And Mary, he is the brother of James the Less, James the son of Alphaeus. So it's interesting to note here, you got Simon Peter and Andrew, they're brothers. You've got James and John, they're brothers. You've got James, the son of Alphaeus, or James the Less. What's it all about? Alphaeus. And Judas Thaddeus. So at least six of the disciples were brothers. And there's some who think that Matthew was also one of the brothers of James and Judas Thaddeus. We'll talk more about it next time, but in Mark chapter 2, because we're about to run out of time, in Mark chapter 2, Matthew is called the son of Alphaeus. So unless it was another Alphaeus, James, Thaddeus, and Matthew would have all been brothers. And if that's the case, that really does say something. We've already said it about Andrew and Simon Peter. That really says something about sharing that kind of news with family. Sharing it with family first. He's called Thaddeus in Mark and Lebbeus in Matthew, but it's the same person. As I said a moment ago, Lebbeus means man of the heart. He lived in Galilee. And if you go to John chapter 14, which we will just for a moment, John chapter 14, verses 22 and 23. Judas, not Iscariot, I want to make sure he's not confusing them here. Judas, not Iscariot, said to him, Lord, how is it that you will reveal yourself to us and not to the world? And Jesus answered him, those who love me will keep my word, and my Father will love them, and he will come to them and make our home with them. He raises a question, and there are some who think he may have been a nationalist, not a zealot, but someone who wanted Jesus to reveal himself, because Jesus says, I will love them, they who have my commandments, verse 21, they who have my commandments and keep them are those who love me, and those who love me will be loved by my Father, and I will love them and reveal myself to them. Jesus says, I'm really only going to reveal my true messiahship and my true inner self to those who listen to my Father, and love me. And James says, well, why not let everybody know? Why not tell the whole nation? Why not tell the whole world? Then everybody will recognize you as king. So he was something, may have been something of a nationalist from the perspective, not a zealot wanting the earthly political kingdom so much as wanting Jesus, if you're really Messiah, if you're really Son of God, and I believe you are, then why are you going to keep it just to confine to a few folks? Why don't you just go ahead and announce it to everybody and reveal it to everybody all at once? Of course, Jesus goes on and talks about the Spirit and those who will receive the Spirit, the Advocate, etc. Tradition says that he traveled and preached in Assyria. In fact, some of the church traditions place him in the town of Edessa, along the Euphrates River, which is where the Assyrian Empire was, the Babylonian Empire was, the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, which run through what was, what still is modern day Iraq. That other I thing, Ed. That other I country. Not Iran, but Iraq. Hippolytus, the Christian writer Hippolytus, says that he traveled not just to Edessa along the Euphrates, but he traveled all over Mesopotamia preaching and teaching about Jesus. And he was killed with arrows near Mount Ararat. Shot through with arrows. Sometimes you will find his symbol containing an arrow, but most of the time his symbol is a ship or a fishing boat, which symbolizes not only that he was also a fisherman in Galilee and a fisher of men, but that in his travels along the Euphrates, and in his travels in Mesopotamia and to Mesopotamia, he went by boat very regularly rather than just walking or riding a horse. Well, that gets us through 7 and to a quarter of 7. I do have the handout for next time, but I think I'll wait and hand it to you next time. Matthew and Philip, Simon Peter, Simon Zelotes, and Didymus are the ones that are left. Didymus the twin, better known as Thomas. But we'll, next Sunday night, we'll talk about those, starting with Matthew. I anticipate we might get Matthew and Philip and start on Simon Peter, but there's a whole lot more about Simon Peter that we do know than we know about some of the others. Questions? Anything you'd like to add? Any questions you'd like to raise? Even those who have nationalistic tendencies, for the most part, seem to have found their way within Jesus' circle and under Jesus' influence. Even Judas Thaddeus, the one who seems to have held on strongest to those nationalistic tendencies, was Judas Iscariot. And he let them go to his head rather than listening to Jesus' teachings. Even when we face questions and we face opportunities to try and learn more, the learning, the speculation is good, but it's not nearly as good as following the teachers of the one whom we follow. God bless you. Go in peace. And I look forward to next time. Amen.